Okay, so tonight we want to take a look at a certain progression that's taken place with regard to the wicked son, and in doing so we're going to try and think about education and how we think about children and how we label children and whether the kinds of labels that are given in the Haggadah actually fit our experience in any meaningful way. I'm going to ask everybody to turn off their cell phones and put them away so we can have your undivided attention. I thought I'd start with just some illustrations. So the first text is from the Amsterdam Haggadah of 1695. It's actually the first illustrated Haggadah to arrange pictures of the four children in one series. And you notice that every culture that Jews have lived in, so the illustrations in the Haggadah become a Rorschach for how Jews of that time think about evil. So given that much of Jewish history, Jews were oppressed physically by the other, often tyrannically. Certainly that was the case in antiquity, it was the case during the Crusades, etc., etc. So it's not a surprise that the depiction of the wicked son is going to be of a soldier, of somebody who is aggressive and physical and oppressive. All right, so in the four across, the larger one, second from the left, is the soldier, and that's the wicked son. When Jews moved to the New World and the issues of what is evil or what is bad shift, right? Because Jews moved to the New World, they're not going up against armies that are trying to kill them and rape them. So it's very interesting that if you look at the Chicago Haggadah of 1879, so there, what is the wicked son? The wicked son is now the assimilated child, right? That was not the depiction of the wicked son in medieval Haggadah. Here, the wicked son is off to the right, he's smoking at the Seder, and obviously the use of color is there to cue us to who's good and who's bad here. So the wicked son is off on the side. He's gesticulating with his right hand as if to sort of oppose his father. You can notice along the far end of the table, so father, mother, and wise child, all in white, wise child kind of bowing obediently, piously. Interestingly, that the Tam, the simple son, and the She'eno Yodei Lishol are also depicted in black. As if to say they're kind of suspicious. We're not sure which way they're going to go. They may be susceptible to the pernicious influence of this wicked child. That's a very important theme in the 19th century. One of the reasons that there was such paranoia about the wicked son wasn't just because of what he said, but to whom he might be saying it. So in other words, you had all these other children at the table, and this is one of the major obsessions of Orthodox families. If one of my kids says something that is not standard theology, all the other kids at the table are going to get corrupted. So you see that very clearly in this depiction of the Chicago Haggadah. And of course, going back to the depiction of physicality as bad, here's a 1920 Haggadah at the bottom of the page, where the Chacham, the wise child, looking not very childlike, but rather sort of grown up and sort of professional Haredi look, clean shaven, black hat, etc., and radical, it's hard to believe these kids are all in the same family, the radical shift to the wicked child, who is, of course, half naked, who is a brute specimen, naked physique, into sports, right? So this is seen as a sign of wickedness. So just to give you a couple of more examples, an illustration before we move to some text, and I don't want to speak for like overly long tonight, I'd like to throw it open to the floor at the end. All right, so Little Midrash Says, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, which is a series for children, which takes Midrashim and kind of converts them into narrative that kids can understand. So here we have the depiction of the Rasha in the Little Midrash Says Haggadah. So notice, one of the great sins there, of course, is the kid is whistling. And those people who have parents from the old country say things like, Jews don't whistle, that kind of thing. So I guess that's what's going in. And it doesn't come off so well in the photocopy, but he's got a kind of lasso type of rope in his right pocket. And I think he's packing some heat there in the left pocket. He's got some sort of firearm. Anyway, this kid looks like something out of the 30s Chicago gangster movies. This is the Rasha in the Little Midrash Says Haggadah. He's like right out of the Bowery Boys. And interestingly, I mean, I find this really funny, Rabbi Wein's Haggadah, right? So the Rasha there with this, like, wraparound headphones, his spiky hair, Discman, and God forbid, he's got a dog. I'm not sure what the dog has to do with reshoot, but in any case, there's wickedness there embodied in his stance and a cell phone, right? The pious, wise child you can see there with his suit and his book, keep on his glasses, the Tom kind of acting oblivious. Shane O'Dea-Elishol is depicted as a baby who is unable to ask, is sucking his finger. One of the things you'll find as you look at illustrated Haggadot of the Rasha, they're always, they're never frontal. They're always looking off to the side. As if to say, we don't engage them, they don't engage us, they're kind of at cross purposes with us. So if you look through the history of illustrated Haggadot, you'll see this over and over and over again. Right? Haggadot is probably the most reproduced text in Jewish history. So there are like thousands of them, all with different kinds of illustrations. And if you go through them, you will see that every time you reach Haggadah, you come to the four children, that will be a cultural template. It will tell you what does that culture think is wise and what does that culture think is wicked. I'm not going to fill the evening with these examples, but it behooves you to go a great Haggadah for that particular aspect is the Hartman Haggadah, a different night Haggadah by Noam Sion, in which he has lots of pictures of the four children. Some of them are just riotous. You know, there's a Haggadah that has the Marx brothers as the four children. Groucho's the Rasha. And there's a really interesting Haggadah, Zionist Haggadah from the 50s, in which the Rasha wears a tie. That's the sign of his evil, actually. So he's got nothing distinguishes him in his look from any of the other children, except he's got a tie, which is like verboten for the new Zionist worker, you know, so that makes him wicked. All right. That's why I'm not wearing one. That's right. One of the best parts of Aliyah is I don't have to pretend that I like wearing a tie anymore. All right, let's take a look at the text. The text is actually very puzzling, right? And I think this has occurred to everybody who's even done any kind of perfunctory study of the four children is how did they get to be this way? In other words, what makes them wise? What makes them wicked? Right? So when you actually trace it out, it's very puzzling. So let's start from the start. How do we get these archetypes of four kids in the Haggadah? It's based on four passages in the Torah in which a child asks or says something to a parent. So Chazal took these four passages, interpreted them, and labeled the child in each of these passages wise, wicked, simple, or unable to ask. But when you go back to the passage and you see what is their proof text for the designation of wise, wicked, simple, or unable to ask, it doesn't really fit, right? A great example is the wicked child. Take a look. In the Torah, in Parshat Bo, in Pasuk Chafav of Perakid Beit, it says, when your children say to you, Mahavodazo lachem, what is this service to you? This question is grabbed onto in the Haggadah as proof that this child is impudent, disobedient, rebellious, and wicked. But what is very striking is that in the original context, in the Torah, the passage certainly doesn't treat the child that way. In other words, it doesn't seem to take umbrage at all at this question. It answers it very simply and matter-of-factly, right? The next pasuk says, you shall say it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, right? It's the Korban Pesach, because he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he killed the Egyptians, but saved our houses. In other words, you asked a question, I gave you an answer. I gave you a factual answer. There's no business of, oh, you asked that question, you obviously exclude yourself from the community and I'm kicking you out, and not at all. You asked a question, what is the service to you? It doesn't strike the text in any way as offensive. We'll answer your question. We'll move on. The rabbis, however, have a completely different take on it and jump on the fact that it said lachem and basically create a whole midrash there that's quoted in the Haggadah that is familiar to all of you as we read it every year, to you but not to him. By excluding himself from the community, he has denied that which is fundamental. So these are all tremendous leaps of logic. Has he really excluded himself from the community? And so on. Has he really denied what is fundamental? We don't even know what the fundamentals here are that are so worthy of exclusion. Separation from the community, obviously, which if you look in Maimonides, is one of the forms of things that can provoke excommunication, can provoke banning, but I don't necessarily know that this child's question implies that this is what is on his mind. But in any case, you blunt his teeth, haked shinav, and you say to him, because of this that God did for me, not for him, and so on, and he went to be redeemed. So we've labeled this child. He's a bad child, excludes himself from the Jewish community, doesn't want to be a part of it, wouldn't have been redeemed, it's all over. Now, what's more interesting is how did this play out historically, and I want to look at several modern examples. And as I said, I'm not going to speak for so long, but we'll talk about it afterwards. So many times throughout Jewish history, there wasn't a conception really of a fractured, fragmented community. So the wicked child, as I said earlier, was depicted in terms of somebody who's almost an outsider to the Jewish people, hence the depiction of him as a soldier or something physical. In the Zik Haggadah of the war era, right, the wicked child is a Nazi. And there were Nazi-like depictions of the wicked child in several Haggadot surrounding the war period. But when it comes to modernity after the Enlightenment, with all of the kind of explosion of denominational warfare that takes place beginning in Germany, right? The first Reformed Temple arises in Hamburg in 1817 and moves its way across Europe and eventually even moves its way to Eastern Europe, right? The flow of assimilation moves from west to east, right? Starts out in the enlightened cosmopolitan areas of Europe, Berlin, etc., but slowly makes its way even to the old world, and we'll see this a little bit later because it shows up in texts even in Poland before the war, right? One of the great mythologies that Orthodoxy has spun in postmodernity is there was really no sort of assimilation that was occurring until like after the Shoah. This is clearly fictitious, as there was an enormous amount of defection in Europe, both in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe prior to the Holocaust. But in any case, the person who most emblematically represents the idea of this culture war is Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Right? Rabbi Hirsch is the leader of German Neo-Orthodoxy. He's born in 1808. He dies in 1888, so he's clearly like the Ur 19th century man. Rabbi Hirsch, if you look at his biography, really, grew up even at his table when he was a little kid listening to arguments about Reform Judaism, because when he's 9 years old, the Hamburg Temple starts, and he actually says in one of his writings that he remembers his father and other people getting together in the kitchen and saying, what are we going to do about these like new sort of incursions into religion? So he sort of was in his blood, this idea of a culture war from a very early age. He uses the opportunity of the wicked son not only to talk about this child, but to talk about what he sees as a generational problem. And he turns it into a paradigm for an entire set of people. The source for this is a essay he wrote, a treatise really, Ma'amar al Arba Banim, the treatise on four kids, which you can now find incorporated into his very own Haggadah called the Hirsch Haggadah, which is published and can be picked up in the bookstore. So if you pick up the Hirsch Haggadah and you go to the wicked child, this is part of what you will read. So let's read it and think about it. Source number four. The Torah foresees times when the younger generation not only will refrain from participating in the festive celebration and observances of their parents and refuse to accept from them that which is holy, but will regard it as their function to criticize their elders for living according to these observances and to undermine with biting sarcasm their parents' loyalty to their religion. The Torah foresees these times when the father will be seated at the Seder table in solemn joy while the quote-unquote progressive son will pass by, mocking with the heart-rending challenge, what is this service to you? So let's pause right there, right? An enormous amount, right, has been heaped onto these four words, right? Because now he's inferring from these four words tone, attitude, conclusion, and of course he's extrapolated from this one boy an entire generation. So an entire generation of kids, clearly he's thinking about Germany, are looking up, rebelling against their parents and the observances of their parents, sarcastic, disobedient, mocking, all because of Ma Voda Zodo Lachem. All right, so now that he's constructed this kind of straw wicked child, he now constructs a remarkable response, and it's worth thinking about this, anybody who's ever taught here and anybody and all of us who are parents, whether we actually admire the response that's being constructed here. He says, how, according to the Torah, should one answer those wayward sons who believe that their apostasy is progressive and who call the loyalty of their fathers outmoded? To them, nothing should be said. He then moves forward and says, to such a generation, right, now we're not just talking anymore, he keeps leaping from the individual child to the paradigm of the entire generation. To such a generation, there's nothing one can say. They expect instruction, no instruction from anyone. After all, and again, you know, it's very ironic, he thinks of the wicked son as sarcastic. Of course, this is, completely projective. There's very few writers, Jewish writers of the 19th century, more sarcastic than Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch when he wants to talk about his enemies. So he says they progressed, obviously sarcastically, far beyond their elders. They would like to rescue their elders from their antiquated outlook, which they think to be burdensome encumbrances. And in their arrogant derision, initiate them, meaning their parents, into their wantonness and facility of their progress. In other words, they want to corrupt the pious. What can one tell this son? After all, he does not speak to receive instruction. So far, he's basically said, the kid's hopeless. Just forget about it. Don't talk to him. Don't say anything. So you might say, if you were like sitting there having a dialogue with Rabbi Hirsch, you'd say, yeah, but you know, like, let's engage the kid. Like, I know this really great teacher, and he's really, he explains Torah so well. Let's sick him on the kid. So Rabbi Hirsch has actually thought about that, and what he says next is really staggering. He says, one cannot expect him, meaning the wicked child, to change his mind as a result of one's words, be they the most brilliant arguments for the Torah, because in his heart of hearts, he's lost his belief in the divine origin of the Torah. So to him, it really ends up being theological. What's the point of talking to this child? It's like apples and oranges. You're going to talk about the Torah and divinity and why we should follow Hashem. They don't believe in it. So there's really no point in talking to this generation. So, I mean, just parenthetically, I spent 18 years at CHAT, and I can tell you that if I took my cue from Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, I wouldn't have had any discussions in the classroom almost at all, right? Because, you know, if you're going to judge people's questions on their theological underpinnings, it's not going to work. But for him, one thing I'd say about Rabbi Hirsch is a very consistent, rigorous thinker. Like, if you look at his other essays, he doesn't really change his mind. He's got an idea, he keeps following it through. And his idea here is that once the principles that you have are totally dissimilar, the basis of dialogue is over. There's nothing to say. The only thing I can say that reminds me of this, just to speak personally, that a long time ago, my wife had her therapy office downtown. It was at Spadina and Harvard. At a certain point, you know, we had one car, so sometimes I would just go downtown and pick her up and bring her home. Now, those of you will remember that the Morgenthaler Abortion Clinic was there. It was actually right near her office. So occasionally I would come and I would see, like, you know, stuff going on outside the clinic, right? The young women would be trying to access the clinic. People would be outside with their placards, you know, talking about baby killing and so on. And there'd be occasionally unpleasant skirmishes and people would yell things. But one of the fascinating things to me about what they were yelling, and it's reminding me of this, is that it was almost a pointless conversation, right? Because one side is essentially saying, you know, this is God's child, God's body, and you're killing this baby. And the other side is saying, this is my body, I'm a woman, I have autonomy over my body, and this is how it goes. So the principles on which they're arguing are so dissimilar, right? Have no common frame of reference that there was really no point in talking. Now, it's true that they really didn't want to talk. They just wanted to yell. But that's what Hirsch is getting at here, that You know, you can have fantastic arguments for Torah, but the person's telling you, I don't believe in Hashem, and I don't believe Hashem gave the Torah, so what are you actually arguing to me for? So what's the point of the discussion? Now, he hasn't taken it in the area or direction which postmodern Jewish education takes it, which we'll talk about later, which is that, talk to him anyway. Don't worry about whether you share fundamental assumptions. Have the conversation and see what comes out of it, right? But for him, we can only have the conversation if our theologies are parallel, then we can have a discussion. If they're not, there's no point in having it. So he actually has a strategy, well, I wouldn't call it a strategy, but he has a prediction of how this person would return to the Jewish fold. But it's not from anything that you're going to say to the child. But rather, let's see what he says. He says, the key to unlocking the hearts of this estranged generation rests in the hands of God. Only experience can bring them back. The experience of emptiness, futility, and frustration. The disillusionment with the frivolous things to which they had turned. This experience will ultimately fill their hearts with longing for the lost happiness which the ancient truth had given them. One will have to wait for that time to arrive. Till then, one is not to tell them anything, not even to reply to their foolish jeering. So this is an amazing picture, right, of this child will leave Judaism and will go through existential torment. It's also like those old movies from the 50s where, you know, the child's at the bus station, the 11 o'clock bus alone on a bench, right? And this child is going to go through all the experiences of life, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and they're going to feel the emptiness and toxic futility of secularism, and they'll kind of crawl their way back. You know, well, maybe they will, maybe they won't. But what's more striking to me is that he feels this is the only way out. In other words, you can't teach them, you can't speak to them, you can't preach to them. They'll either come back or they won't, and they'll come back when they're so totally frustrated by that other life, that other world, that they'll come running back to the ancient truth. That is his prescription for how this child will come around, right? It's remarkable how he has no confidence that any kind of discourse with this child will make any difference at all, right? The only thing you've got is silence. Let's just finish up the passage. On the other hand, he says, one is not to remain completely silent. The Torah instructs the father not to answer him, but it most decidedly enjoins him, you shall say. In other words, the father has to talk, just not to this child. So who's he talking to? He's talking across the table. I'm trying to picture, logistically, what does the Seder table look like, right? The kid asks the question, and dad kind of purposefully stares past this child to all the other children and speaks to them as if this child is not in the room. All the more firmly and clearly is he to state his certainty in the face of his son's disbelief, his resolve in the face of his son's hesitancy, his vitality in the face of his son's decadence. One is to speak up even when all around him remains silent or when all around him suggests he should be ashamed of being a Jew. So he definitely wants the father to speak, and he wants him to speak emphatically in favor of Torah Judaism, but just not to engage that child. Just a note, source 5, I spoke before about the fact that he was a fairly consistent thinker. So here's one of his more well-known essays from 1854 called Religion Allied to Progress. Now, the truth is that, you know, the terms we use today, as we all well know, are made-up terms from the 19th century. There's no such thing as Orthodox Judaism or Reformed Judaism or Conservative Judaism. These are all modern inventions. But to be fair, right, Orthodoxy does not, you know, fire the first bullet, right? Reform Judaism attacks traditionalists as backwards and obscurantist and archaic, and this really exercises Rabbi Hirsch. He's very upset that they come swinging out of the box, taking shots at us. So, you know what? He swings back. He swings back strongly and bitterly, right? And here's one of his, you know, great sessions in the ring, which is Religion Allied to Progress. And again, you will note the kind of sharp, almost, you know, sardonic tone. Reform Judaism has turned irreligion into godliness, apostasy into priesthood, sin into merit, frivolity into virtue, weakness into strength, thoughtlessness into profundity. those are its good points, right? What is this progress, right? He keeps coming back to the fact that his Reformed co-religionists keep stressing the fact that they're progressive and they're forward-thinking and so on. So he says, what is this progress? It means progress in every sphere other than religion. Speaking frankly, then, it means religion as long as it does not hinder progress. Religion as long as it is not onerous or inconvenient. You must admit it. It is only because religion does not mean to you the Word of God. Because in your heart you deny divine revelation. Because you believe not in revelation given to man, but revelation from man. That you can give man the right to lay down conditions to religion. That's a fairly strong argument. And I'm not sure he's wrong, actually. He's actually saying, you know, really, this is all baloney. Like, let's really call it for what it is. You guys don't believe in divine authorship of the Torah. You believe in human-constructed religion. So, of course, you feel utterly unencumbered and free to do whatever it is you want and call it progress. Because it's easy to be progressive when you feel you have, you know, nothing to listen to, nothing to obey, nothing that's demanded of you. So this is a constant war that he fought for decades. And the wicked son is really just an imaginative construct for Rabbi Hirsch to capture this culture war that took place for decades. This child becomes the embodiment of everything that he doesn't like about the kind of upsurge and defection from Judaism in the 19th century. Okay. Now, not everybody is a Hirschian, and it's really interesting to see how other people in the 20th century begin to negotiate wickedness and wisdom. One of the more fascinating and really poignant examples comes from the Eish Kodesh, Rabbi Kleinemus Kalman Shapira. Right? As you all know, Rabbi Shapira was the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, who was murdered in 1943. And he's, of course, known from the book that was discovered by the kid after the war, who gave it to the American soldier, which is the Eish Kodesh, the Holy Fire, which are his drashot that were, you know, written down afterwards that he was writing, thinking about saying in the ghetto. But the only book, right, he only has one book that was published during his lifetime, and it's Chovat HaTalmidim, right, A Student's Obligation, which is published in Warsaw in 1932. And it's really, to me, amazing to read this book 83 years later, because you really feel like it could be written yesterday. It's remarkably progressive. I mean, think about it. This man is from a Hasidic dynasty living in the heart of sort of Hasidic Warsaw, but he certainly does not have his head buried in the ground. So let's compare what he has to say. This isn't specifically on the Haggadah, but it clearly is talking about quote-unquote wicked children, and compare it to Rav Hirsch. And it's striking because he's living in Warsaw and Rav Hirsch is living in Frankfurt. So you would think that one is really ensconced much more in modernity and the other one in the old world. And yet, this is what Rav Shapira writes. We should be heartsick and our hair should stand on end when we see the way the younger generation has turned to heresy and has lost all spiritual discipline. They possess neither faith nor fear of God nor knowledge of Torah. They have come to despise God and his servants, the people of Israel. The administrators and deans of the yeshivot, who are totally immersed in the life of the yeshiva and its students, and encounter only the elite of our youth, are unaware of the gravity of this problem. They console themselves saying, yes, it may be true that many of the young people have freed themselves from any commitment to Torah, but still, Israel's not been abandoned. There are still young men, sons of our people, outstanding in their Judaic scholarship, whose heart is steadfast with the Lord. Poke your heads outside of the four cubits of your yeshiva. You will see the great mass of people who have broken from the observances of our faith. May God have mercy on them and us. You will see houses of study where the destruction of Jerusalem has been reenacted. So he's not happy with this kind of blissful obliviousness which the heads of yeshivot seem to have. And it's a remarkable statement. He's saying, look, do you understand what's going on? People are leaving in droves. And you console yourself with the fact that you have some academic elites at your yeshiva and they steig all day, so you're happy with that and it doesn't matter about the rest? Poke your heads out of your, you know, clue into what's really going on. And now he offers a very progressive educational philosophy and says, the education of each and every child must therefore be different, depending on his or her nature, mind, character, and all other unique qualities. The educator must become aware of these qualities. It will not suffice for the teacher to know himself and his own mind alone, since everything depends on the student being educated. Don't teach them according to what's in your head. Find out who you're teaching. Find out their uniqueness, their individuality, and speak to that. And then he says something even more remarkable. He says, every father and every teacher knows that their children and students will not remain children forever, yet there exist fathers and teachers who are concerned only with what they see right now. And since all they see right now are children, the goal of their efforts is to educate their charges to become good children, right? Which is a fabulous insight. Like, are you seeing where you want them to go? Or is your only goal just to make them nice boys and girls for the next 6 months or 12 months? Because you have to see further, and to see further means you have to see who this child really is. And to see who this child really is means not to get stuck in labeling them too quickly and with too much predetermination. Because everybody, all of us, are always, hopefully, in flux. We don't remain static, or we shouldn't remain static. And certainly when you're younger and you're going through school, you're definitely not remaining static. Now, I don't know how you felt about school, but I think school is boring. And I always felt that way, and I think one of the reasons I became a teacher was to sort of undo the boredom I felt when I was a student. But to sit 8 hours on a bench all day and listen to somebody frankly drone on and on and on is not my idea of a good time. So I have great empathy for students who feel bored. But if you're not going to excuse them for being bored, you can at least encounter or engage them for the parts that they feel excited by. Take a look at the ending of this passage at the top of the next page. And compare this, of course, to what we read in Rabbi Hirsch. Even if some of the children seem rebellious or flawed in their character, the teacher must know that the nature of soul seeds, of unripe angels, is to taste bitter as they are ripening and be filled with nectar in their maturity. Neither the nature nor any particular quality of the Jewish child is absolutely evil. We tend to look at the straying of our youth as if they alone were to blame and we were completely innocent. We must acknowledge our share of guilt. For even if they are flawed in a way that previous generations of young people were not, this does not justify our neglecting them or our failure to investigate and discover the source of their soul sickness while they are still young. Right? I mean, when you think of the cultural context in which this is being written, it's just singularly remarkable. It would be remarkable if you wrote it yesterday, but it's certainly remarkable in Warsaw of the 30s and worth taking to heart. So the question is whether we think of kids who are bad in ways that are irredeemable, right? Rabbi Hirsch is basically saying they're not redeemable. They have to come back to it on their own. Rabbi Shapira is certainly saying that no child is ever beyond redemption. You do have, in the tradition, of course, archetypes of good and bad that are portrayed as almost genetic and beyond fixing. Now, all of you will remember the Midrash that's quoted by Rashi at the beginning of Parsha Toldot in Source 7, which talks about the fact that, you know, Rivka was pregnant, and it says in the Pasuk, Vihidrotzitzu Habanim, that the children are struggling inside of her. And so to comment on this struggle, the Midrash says that whenever a pregnant Rivka walked past the doors of the Torah, which is the schools of Shem and Aver, Yaakov moved to be born convulsively. But whenever she walked past a pagan temple, Esav struggled to be born, which is Chazal's way of grappling the idea of genetics, right? That some kids just seem like from the get-go inclined in a bad direction and others don't. But the question of whether this is really true, I mean, for Rev Shapiro, you can't say that statement in too petrified a manner. You can't just freeze it at that. You've got to give the potential for the kid to evolve and develop no matter what their natural inclinations were. Now, when you come to really contemporary Haggadot, where much of the attitude has changed, and I would in many ways say that a central person who changed the attitude to kids in this way is the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the 1950s. right, if you trace it back. Because after him, if you look at his students, and we'll look at two of his famous students, they completely changed the notion of what's redeemable, what's not redeemable, right? In the early days of Chabad, in the 50s, right, his two most famous students are, of course, Shlomo Carlebach and Zalman Schachter Shalomi, and take a look at their Haggadot, right? So in the Carlebach Haggadah, in source 8, which I think probably should be kind of sing-song rather than said, right? Let me tell you about the four children, right? Here's a great Carlebachian dichotomy. It just fools you. Some children are good, some are the best, right? Classic Carlebach. Some are clever and some are not so clever. Seder night gives me a taste of how much God believes in all of them, right? We're a long way from Rabbi Hirsch now. Sometimes you see young people are a little off. You know why? Because there wasn't anyone to believe in them. It's so easy to get off the highway when no one believes in you. Our holy rabbis teach us that the chacham, the clever boy, is very beautiful as long as you think that being clever is everything. He even gets in a little diss for the chacham there, right? The clever person isn't far away from the wicked person. Who do you think the wicked child is? Someone who is never told how holy he is. So some people will love this, and some people will find it very sort of treacly and sentimental and so on. That's fine. But the mentality is strikingly contemporary, right? This is a product of the New Age, of modernity, where attitudes to education, attitudes to disaffection change. One of the reasons they change is because disaffection is the norm now, right? There's a wonderful passage in Peter Berger's book, The Heretical Imperative, which came out in 1979, which is really one of the best books written about religion in the modern world, The Heretical Imperative. And Berger points out that what's changed in modernity because of choice is that religion has become the countercultural thing. In other words, it is the exception. Fidelity to religion is really the exception choice. Disaffection is the norm. It's what is. And he goes through a long constructed argument about the fact that it is that way because choice creates a brand new world where people choose out of religion. But I'm pointing out that the trend to these kinds of Haggadot, even in the Orthodox world, is as a result of this enormous upheaval that's taking place demographically, where there's a recognition that if you're going to be a Hirschian hardliner into the 21st century, you can wave goodbye to everyone. They'll wave goodbye to you on their way out. They're not intimidated by that kind of rejection. You reject me, fine. Bye. You know, that's not a strategy that's going to get anywhere, right? So newer forms of Haggadot, especially on the kind of New Agey Orthodox side, will definitely stress the redeemability, the potential of each child. But you even saw that in Rabbi Shapira, right, in the 30s in Warsaw. It's not like a new kind of a newfangled American invention. But obviously it reaches its apotheosis with Rabbi Carlebach. Very interesting. There's a sefer that Zalman Schachter put out that was published a couple of years ago called Yishmeru Dat. And here, look how he relabels the four children, right? Number 9. One's a lamdan, that's the chacham, a sharp student. What's the rasha? He's the high emotional quotient child, you know? And when he comes to the passage which says, you know, chacham mahomer, rasha mahomer, so look what he says here. The high emotional quotient one, what does he say? Not the wicked one, what does he say, right? So what's this wicked child? The child is sensitized, right? You know, what we call wicked children in families is usually the kid who asks the question we don't like. It's what therapists call the identified patient, right? The one who's out there saying the things that everybody's kind of thinking but don't like to admit, right? And this child will ask the kind of embarrassing, tough questions. And when we don't like those questions, so we give this kid a label. Sometimes we give them a label as a wicked child. But in any case, that's what's underneath Rabbi Zalman Schachter's idea here, which is this is a child who really has high emotional quotient. So she says, make an effort to rein in his longings, for he also wants to be part of the integrity and perfection that comes with meaningful rituals. I don't know if that's true or false, but he's really giving him a lot of rope, right? If you are loving, then he will understand dvekut and cleaving, and he will get a taste of what it means to feel close to God, right? So there's no rejection. I'll take questions later. There's no rejection. There's no final judgments on this child. The slate is still open completely. All right. We'll just finish off here. Some of you may be familiar with this passage. If not, it's quite lovely. It's from the chief rabbi's Haggadah, Jonathan Sacks, and this is his comment on the Rosh Hashanah. And this is a particularly contemporary sort of Western context. When is the child whom others see as wicked, the adolescent, the rebel, the breakaway, really signaling by his conduct? We know what he says, but what's the question beneath the words, the inarticulate cry? So here Rabbi Sacks, in a way, constructs a modern midrash. Father, mother, what does Judaism mean to you? You sent me to Hebrew school, you gave me a bar mitzvah, you hired teachers for me. I know what Judaism is supposed to mean. I listened to the lessons, I read the books. But all the time I was growing up, you sent me mixed messages. When I neglected my secular education, you were angry. But when I missed Hebrew lessons, you never seemed to mind. I learned about the laws of Jewish life, but you did not seem to keep them. Or if you did so, you did it selectively. What you said was that Judaism mattered, but what you did seemed to show that it did not matter very much. At my bar mitzvah, you were more concerned about the catering than about how much I understood of the words I said in synagogue. As I grew older, you seemed more interested in which college I went to and which career I pursued than whether I was continuing to study and practice Judaism. You wanted me to marry a Jewish girl, but you never gave me a real reason why. I know what Judaism is supposed to mean to me, but you're my parents. I'm Jewish only because you are. So I ask you, from the depths of my soul, what does Judaism mean to you? So this is a complete reformulation of the question, right? Those four words, which in Rabbi Hirsch's hands were the product of a disobedient, rebellious, sarcastic mind, in Rabbi Sacks's hands, it's really all about tone. You know, that's one of the things about texts, especially the Bible. There's no stage directions. You can't really sense what's actually going into the inflection of the voice. So for Rabbi Sacks, when he says, what does this service mean to you? He means it. He doesn't understand. He's confused between what the upbringing said on one level and what it said on another level. Right now, obviously, this is addressing a certain kind of demographic that was very popular and remains popular in North American and English Jewry, the person who sort of gets some Jewish stuff but is not halachic. You know, and the parents are not really passionate about the Jewish stuff. So there's kind of this massive mixed message. So the child is saying, like, I don't get it. What's up? Right. So they're very sympathetic reading to this supposedly wicked boy in several contemporary Haggadot. And even the ones that aren't, you know, explicitly sympathetic, blunt the real force of what seems to be evil. If you look in the Breslov Haggadah, for instance, what's called the wayward son in the Breslov Haggadah is also, there's commentary about the idea that these are all mixtures of character traits inside of us, that nobody is just one or the other. There's a kind of fusion. All of that kind of discussion where the four children are not easily typecast. And every human being, in fact, has a version of the four children inside of them, is a way of completely revolutionizing how we look at the wicked child. I said earlier that I thought a lot of this stemmed from the influence of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who early in 57 in Source 11 says the following. There also exists a fifth son. The Jew is absent from the Seder table. He asks no questions, poses no challenges, displays no interest. He knows nothing of the Seder, nothing of the significance of the Exodus, nothing of the revelation at Sinai, which we assumed our mission and role as Jews. You know what? There's something much worse than the wicked child at your table. That's the disinterested, bored, I'm gone Jew who doesn't care. You know, the child is there. How can this child be wicked? The child is there. The child is engaged. The child's asking a question. Now, we could turn that into a rhetorical question, even if it's rhetorical. So answer the kid. Right? So there's something much worse, the Rebbe implies, which is the child who no longer has any interest in the Jewish tradition. So the bottom line is that our attitude to the wicked child is really emblematic of our attitude to people asking questions. And it is deeply ironic that in a ritual that claims to want to entice and engage people in asking questions, that we take one of those questions and throw it back in the person's face. I'll just end, and I'm happy to take any questions, with a good comment by Milan Kundera, the brilliant Czech author. When he was interviewed by Philip Roth, in Czechoslovakia in 1980, he'd come out to Paris, which is where Roth met him. Stupidity stems from people thinking that they have an answer for everything. A writer teaches the reader to perceive the world as a question. There is wisdom and patience in this approach. In a world created out of absolute certainties, the story dies. The totalitarian world is based on answers instead of on questions. In that world, the story has no place. In any event, it appears to me that all over the contemporary world, people prefer to pass judgment rather than to understand, prefer to answer rather than to question. And I think that would be a good frame to think about The Wicked Child. Okay, I'm happy to take any questions. Yes. It was too long, but I'll give you the source for it. It's a piece called Confessions of a Wicked Daughter that appeared in Tablet Magazine on March 25th, 2013 by a woman named Deena Shanker, D-E-E-N-A-S-H-A-N-K-E-R. It's actually quite funny. Yes. You're first.
I wanted to address the question of the label of the Rasha, which always bothered me. My first question would be, is it assumed that the intellectual level of the Chacham is on a higher level than the Rasha? Those of us who have been in education, in dealing with students, I think could attest to the fact, and I think you alluded to it, that sometimes the students who might be designated as a Rasha is really not evil, is rebellious, can be very bright, and sometimes, if treated properly, can end up to be potentially some of the finest products from the education system. So I'm not sure that the midrash of setting the teeth on edge or even knocking out his teeth, if the question is deemed to be so extreme and reprehensible, that is the pedagogic approach to that kind of student.
Right, surely not. But as to your earlier question, it's hard to answer, almost unanswerable. It gives you the illusion that they think of this wise child as the wisest because they're designating him as a wise child, right? So it's interesting that the wicked child's being judged and rated and gauged not on his intellectual ability, but rather his desire to exclude himself from the community and probably some form of religious rebelliousness. There's no sort of judgment that's being rendered on how smart or not smart he is. In fact, the tradition would be rueful about the fact that he probably is smart because it would see it as intelligence in the service of immorality and therefore to be feared.
Would be more accepting, right, than the Rasha who would be always questioning that's the difficult charge in the family that you don't deal with properly, you can end up with a real problem.
Right. Well, you see with Karlbach and Schachter that one of the sub-themes of their text is that cognitive intelligence isn't everything, right? That emotional intelligence is just as important, if not more important, right? That there's actually quite a stinging critique going on there in the tradition. And we see it every day in our schools, right? What is valued, especially in Orthodox schools, is brains and a certain kind of rigid kind of learning. Now, it happens to be that I like that learning, but that's immaterial, right? What should be material is to value and celebrate the different sorts of contributions that kids can make, and not all of them are set to sit for 6 hours a day or 12 hours a day and learn Talmud, right? So you see in their commentary on the Wicked Child that they're reinterpreting this child as having high emotional intelligence. And therefore, that's something to be celebrated as opposed to being denigrated. Now, whether on the cognitive level, the Rasha and the Chacham are equal is impossible to say. Yes, sir.
So, I want to comment something on the last, on Rabbi Zamsacher.
Yep.
I don't know where you got it from.
He made it up.
Yeah, he made it up.
He did.
And apparently, one of the mother used the late father Rabbi Zamsacher in Toronto.
Okay. Thank you for that piece of information. Yes, yes, ma'am.
When did nobody directly commented on what the fact is? If you see the Shein Yodeh Lishol of the baby, presumably there's a certain birth order here. And for any of us who've had a series of sons, the second son is often a problem. Well, because, like, you know, there's that perfect first son, right? bar in school or great at sports or whatever, and then the second kid has to carve out his own stuff.
Right, live in the shadow of the first one, right. Yeah, no, I mean, it could be so. Look, I don't think anybody really recognizes these children as discrete individuals. It just doesn't work that way. And even if they are discrete individuals, it's quite mysterious and murky as to why they got to where they got to. To take an example that you've now alluded to. The She'eno Yodei Lishol, who is this child, right? So in the Rabbi Weintraub Haggadah, he's like a little baby thumb-sucking. But what's, to me, interesting is to ask yourself, what does it mean that a child doesn't ask questions or is incapable of asking questions or doesn't know how to ask questions, depending on how you want to translate that? Now, the obvious answer is his youth, right? He's a toddler or he's below toddler age, whatever. But what if he's not, right? What if he's a teenager? What does it mean that a teenager doesn't know how to ask questions? You know, my experience in the classroom is that a question that isn't asked is not a question that wasn't contemplated. The child is picked up in a very visceral way that this is not a place, this is not an atmosphere that invites questioning, so I am not going to ask. There are many children who are very, very conscious of their own silence. And they're very conscious of the fact that they won't ask questions to that teacher because they know what's coming. So it may be a question of ignorance, it may be a question of youth, and it may also be a question of shame. Right? So it all depends what you want to do with this child and what you want to invest, because it's an open question as to what's really going on with that kid. Simplicity as well. What does tam mean? It could be wholeness. It could be simple-mindedness. You know, it leaves the interpretive field wide open. Right? Yes, sir?
I'm still kind of puzzled by your opening, you know, how the Midrash could create such a narrative about it, and I'm just wondering if there's other examples of Midrash or other statements in the Torah that seem to be pretty, you know, innocuous or harmless, and where the interpretation is equally as radical or as profound. Like, is this a one-off? Or
so I'm going to answer that first of all by just professing ignorance. Like, I'm not a Midrashic scholar at all. It's not my field. Bichlal. I would say that some have suggested that the great sort of invisible card here is Christianity, right? That it is possible that, you know, they're dealing with like sort of sects that are turning off. There's pagans and there's new Christians, and it could be that they're seeing they're kind of cautioning and kind of against a kind of rebellion in their ranks. But I don't know if that's true historically or not. As to whether Midrash will sometimes go a kilter, my impression has always been that that's basically what it does, right? There's a whole tradition in Jewish intellectual history of what I would call countertexts, which basically move far away from the tone, the feeling, the content of the sentence in front of you, and they're ideologically driven. You know, when I was many centuries ago, when I was a student at U of T, and I was doing my work in English literature, so one of my first teachers was a man named Northrop Frye. And Frye was a beyond a brilliant man. He was also a very humble person. And he used to say often that you cannot separate reading from ideology. In other words, that people read things and interpret things sometimes based on a way that they want to picture the world and communicate the world. So they took it as an opportunity to communicate a value system that they wanted to communicate. And you see this often in Midrashim, both with values you might like and values you might not like. Just to give a parallel example of something, you know, we just read Parshat Zachor not long ago. Right, this is a very famous passage in Yomah and Chaf Beit where the rabbis start, you know, injecting a speech into Shaul HaMelech's mouth. Right, Shaul HaMelech is commanded in chapter 15 of Shmuel to go out and obliterate the Amalekites, which is a brutal mission. And he, quote-unquote, fails because he leaves alive King Agag and the sheep. So God sends Shmuel to tell Shaul, that's it, you're done. You're done as king, you failed miserably, and so on. In the Gemara, right, they have Shaul saying to God, what's going on here? You're telling me to obliterate the entire Amalekite nation. Meanwhile, you have a mitzvah in Parshat Shoftim, Egla Arufa, which is about the idea that if you have an unsolved homicide They take this heifer in the valley and they break its neck. You're so concerned about one dead person that you would create this ritual around it, and you want me to kill all these people? And then the passage goes on and says, and if you want me to kill the men, why the women, why the children, why the cattle? And God, which, you know, God as a character often does this, basically tells him, you know, shut up. He says, Altiet Sadekarbe, don't be so righteous. In other words, don't question me. We're not having conversations, not a dialogue, forget it. Now, what are Chazal doing there? Right? Chazal are actually expressing deep uneasiness with that kind of violence through the expression of a biblical figure. That happens all the time in Midrashic texts, all the time. What you're learning about is Chazal's grappling with values, with Jewish values, with how does it work, with what you know, the reception they had of the Bible and what they did with that and how to reflect it. What's remarkable, you know, David Herman used to point out this all the time, that forget about that our values are not consonant with biblical values. Chazal's values were already far away from biblical values, and there's tons of examples, not, you know, whether it's genocide or capital punishment or Ben Sora Moreh, whatever it is, right? They were already moving far away, right? So, yeah, Midrash often takes simple texts and makes something much grander of them, because that's what the project is. It's not about, you know, it's not like the Rashbam where you're like, you know, you're following the words. You really want to develop an ideology. And really, to me, the apex of all this is mysticism, right? Where you're reading texts in the Zohar that are not, they're not, you know, so if a literary critic came and read Zohar, they would say this is just a countertextual. It's not dealing with the language at all, right? The Pasuk says Billy went to the store to get ice cream. And the Zohar is talking about, well, that means that that sphere connected to, you know, it's not talking about content at all. So much of reading is the construction of ideological interpretation, which leads to a further question, which is, and what interpretations do we like? Right. Often when you talk about religious tradition, you're not talking about right and wrong. You're talking about which traditions do you authorize to speak for you, speak to you, seem authoritative to you. And, you know, in a way, that's why, oddly enough, I really am a fan of halakha, because halakha gives you the freedom to think, because it's the common denominator glue that allows everybody, when they're off in the privacy of their own mind, thinking what they really think about theology, to say, okay, we can at least, you know, eat together, talk together, commune together, and we can have all sorts of radical thoughts on the side, right? Yeah.
I find that the term Rasha has been chosen with a specific purpose. I mean, it's a very term that we don't often hear. We talk about Haman Rasha.
Right.
My connotation, and we're trying to stop Petal, I think, a lot of these ideas, is a Rasha is a person who's a danger to society. Now, if you look at, you know, the Bracha and Shmon Esrei, I mean, where the word Rasha appears, we talk about Mamshini.
Right.
I think, in my mind, Chazal are saying, look, there are people in your midst that are dangers to you, and
right,
you do have to exclude them from your society.
Right.
I mean, they could be informers to the government. They could be people who are plotting against the establishment. And I think that, I mean, I think this was done on purpose. And doesn't seem to appear in your...
I mean, that could all be true, but of course, there's nothing that this child says that would make me think
that he's the subject
of this witch hunt.
But
right?
Obviously, the connotation is that, I mean, there's somebody at your table who could be dangerous to...
Well, that's Hirsch's approach, right?
Well, not quite. He's saying, well, leave him, give him time, he'll come back, and this and that.
I think that's the only way there's ever any hope for him, I think is what he's saying.
But I mean, I think that Chazal are much more, strong in their approach.
I think it's possible to say, of course it's possible to say that there are bad people and bad, I mean, obviously we see that all the time. There are children who are really troubling. I mean, we're not talking about, but when we think about wicked children, modernity, we're thinking about people who, you know, commit violence and are, you know, pathological or sociopaths or whatever. We're not thinking about like a kid who sits at the table and says, what is the service to you? Right? So it's the language just seems freighted in ways that we don't connect with. In other words, there's really, it's a language that no longer speaks to us at all. So that's what's odd about it. I don't deny for a moment that there is wickedness in this world, right? I'm a Burkean. I'm a conservative in that sense. I do believe there's bad people out there, but I just don't know if this child, based on what he asked, qualifies. Yeah.
Yeah, because I find a disconnect to label this person as being a Russian. First of all, as you said, he's asking the question. He's
right.
Engaged enough that he's asking the question. And to me, the question is not that he's excluding himself, but he's trying to understand how he finds it meaningful. Mahavagahazo,
right.
Tell me so I can try to connect.
Right.
And the answer is much more disturbing than the question.
Correct. As most answers usually are. Right. No, it's a terrible answer. But most answers are worse than the questions. Almost inevitably. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
It seems to me that there is a purpose for calling this Russia. He's not being castigated because he's asking questions. He's being castigated on two grounds. One, Kafar Bikar, that he's denying some fundamental of the faith, but more importantly, that he excludes himself from the community. And I think that the Haggadah has two sides to it. One is, he got to believe in Ha, tell your child, and the other is, Chayav Adam Rivar Asma, And so the other side, so one is the parent has to tell the child, and the other part is the child has to accept it. And so that the four children have to be understood in that light. And here is the kid who doesn't accept it. I mean, I don't see him as being some danger to the Jewish community, some terrible person. But I think rereading the four children and making the Rasha the best child misses the point. That the point is that Jews are supposed to accept the Passover story. That's all it's saying. And I think the question, I think there are two issues. One is, what to do about the Rasha. The second question is what to do about the Rasha. But to say that he's not Rasha, and of course Rasha is a very loaded word. I mean, the Nazis are called Rasha. Forget about Haman. It's a very loaded word. But still, I think the Haggadah is trying to tell you something here. And what it's not telling you is that this is the best child.
Right, but I still think this is highly problematic. In other words, there's nothing that this child says that, to me, would lead to that kind of labeling. Think about the people you know in your community. Right? Think about people who, quote-unquote, exclude themselves from the community. What does that mean? They don't go to shul. They're not keeping Shabbat. These people are wicked. Like, what do we mean when we call people wicked in modernity? It's that simple.
Well,
what do we mean by that?
What it's saying, I don't know if that's resonance for me, that Jews are supposed to stay Jewish. I don't care how people define themselves as Jews.
And if they don't, they're wicked?
Well, personally, I would say yes.
I would demur. I really would. No. I don't know that
I'm not interested in how people
right.
define themselves, but I think you either define yourself either, you define yourself out, and defining yourself out is for me extremely problematic.
Right.
I think it's trying to say is
it could be. Right. In other words, let's not the last part of what you're saying. Is the term really softer than it is? Right. Is it really just meant as a catch-all for defection or assimilation? But as you pointed out, they mean what they say. Right. There is a term of reshoot that is widely used, right, in the Talmud for a whole variety of sins. I just don't know. I'm just not convinced yet that what this boy has done has risen to that level. I'd want to see more evidence. I'd want to see evidence that this child has really done something that approximates that. But that's a puzzle bichlal about the biblical depiction of children. When you come to the story of the rebellious son in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 18 to 21. I'm similarly flustered. What did he do that you're hauling him out to the town square and the elders and stoning him to death?
Well, I don't think that the prescription of what to do with him is correct. But I think that it is posing the second side of the story, which is the obligation to accept the story. And I have one other question. In Arabic, kufr is apostasy, and I've sort of searched in vain to try to see if Gafar B. Tar has any
I mean, the Arabic is actually, I mean, it goes back further, you know, older than Islam, that term, obviously. So we see it in Jewish terminology as well. So, you know, I can't speak to the Islamic tradition.
No, but I'm telling you, in Arabic I know.
Right.
Kufr is
right.
So my question is in Judaism, is kafar b'ikar, Arabic kufr, which is apostasy.
Yes. We're good?
I'm thinking that, you know, but
you want to think aloud?
The of Russia are much different, perhaps, than
right.
the office of the mentors. In other words, in
sure.
Rambam,
sure.
Russia is a person who is like, you know, many Yitzvot, 51% of Eruv, 49% of Yitzvot. And Eloi Yashna Loya Nigal, according to Chazal, 80% of the Jews in the Leave Egypt, they weren't Nigalu. So it could be, I don't know, it could be in those. We think of it, oh, it's terrible, but in that sense, there are most, what I've got to say, who's going to make the future for the Jewish people? They say most Jews, even the Jews are not, they're not interested. They're Risham, not Risham of evil, like we use the term evil in all the commentaries, of course, but perhaps Russia just meant someone who didn't have what it took to be a future sort of leader, to be part of the 20% of the Jewish people. I don't know.
You know, I'm just going to close with a you're right. And I'm going to close with a meta comment. One of the hard parts for me about Judaism is that I often feel stuck between a rock and a hard place. What do I mean? If you take statements that are made literally, in other words, if this is what they really mean, they often run up against your modern sensibility. And if you metaphorize them, they run up against, they make it just lighter. They just don't make it as substantive. A great example to me is this whole business of life and death, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, right? You look through those pages in Masechet Rosh Hashanah that talk about, you know, the books being taken out and, you know, the Rasha and the Tzaddik and the Benoni and it's being written, da-da-da, and all sorts of questions emerge that are really unsettling, right? You mean like God is really paying attention to me now, in this time, and not in like a rainy night in February? And what does it mean, they go 51, 49? Because you're quite right. I mean, the Rambam gets that from the Gemara, but you know, so if I say that there's a book of life and God is writing it, and it's all metaphorical, right? It's just one big allegory, which is basically how I tend to take it, there's a sense of kind of fluff that enters into it that is hard to push off. Like I'm now basically turning all of it into some sort of symbolic language. But I can't take it literally because I just don't believe in it. So you're really, in some ways, you get stuck in a traditional mode. Although I don't in any way think that way, I'm actually very appreciative of how some of my Haredi co-religionists think. I even understand the mentality that would lead them to think in such a way, because it's cleaner to not have to approach texts and have to do things with them. Like Chazal says, a Russian is a Russian, right? And I've met people who think exactly this way, right? But to begin to move into the territory of saying it can't be and it must be something else because it doesn't speak to me, it doesn't, you know, so then you're sort of swimming around trying to find new theological language, and that bespeaks a whole new attitude to Judaism. And you see this in so many places. I mean, you see this here, you see this in discussions of theodicy, why bad things happen and so on. I mean, this isn't the time and place to get into all those passages, but I'm saying that this is really, to me, symbolic of a much larger theological struggle that I think people go through. Some people go through it more overtly, and other people are silent about it and don't speak of it, but I think they go through it, because I think to be a sensitized human being in the 21st century, you can't simply surrender to all of this language. You have to do something with it. Anyway, Chag Sameach to all of you. Be well.